I'm Assistant Professor Jason Hare, and this is the Be Excited Podcast, where we break down the physician assistant profession from PA education to PA practice. Hey folks, welcome to the Be Excited Podcast. This is Professor Hare, and today on episode 3, we have with us for our hematology-oncology discussion, Lydia Popachak. Welcome to the podcast, Lydia. Thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about what your service is, where you're working, and what kind of work you do there and why you like that work.
I graduated back in 2018, and for the first 3 years, I worked on the malignant hematology service at Shadyside Hospital, which was a new service at the time. I was one of the first couple people on that service when we started it. And it was a new service that took care of the lymphoma, myeloma, chronic leukemia, and myeloproliferative disease patients. So from working them up to treating them to basically taking care of anything that they had going on. We were a primary service that also took care of the oncologic needs. We manage everything from blood pressure to surgical need to diabetes on our service, but then we also take care of their heme issues too.
One thing that I think is often misunderstood, at least by students in this process, is the difference between oncology as a solid tumor service versus a hematology oncology service, which covers leukemia, lymphomas, proteinemias, multiple myeloma. The tumor side of things is more bulky disease where we're seeing an actual nidus of tumor somewhere in the body for that. How would you describe the primary hematologic oncologic focus that you had?
These usually originate either in the bone marrow or the spleen or a lymph node. So a lot of times when you think of the leukemia, that originates in the bone marrow, and then the lymphomas originate in the lymph nodes, but they can arise other areas in the body, but those are the main areas that they're involved in.
This is a source of a lot of cells that are often problematic throughout the entire body. Those blast cells creating new cells that are proliferating and moving throughout the body in the bloodstream, so white cells and in the lymphatic system. Why did you initially go into heme-onc? So you went straight out of school, right?
Yeah, actually pre-PA, I was a patient care technician on the bone marrow transplant floor at Shadyside, and I've always loved that world. Those people, you get to have a good relationship with them and their families, and you spend a lot of time with them. I've always liked that, so I knew I wanted to do that when I started, and unfortunately there wasn't a bone marrow transplant job available at the time.
I find it interesting, this particular area of medicine that have a significant diagnosis to begin with, a significant morbidity and mortality causing diagnosis to begin with. I don't know that I could actually do that, if I'm honest.
It's definitely a lot, especially when you work someone up and sometimes you're with these people from their diagnosis to their death. And it's definitely straining sometimes, but it is nice to be able to really get to know them and know their families and be with them through their whole process, whether it's good or bad. And it is nice when we get to see people finish their chemo too. So it has its rewarding time as much as it has its hard times.
In other words, it seems to be emotionally rewarding, but at the same time, emotionally draining at times. So I appreciate that. The procedural side of things, the bone marrow biopsies that you're doing more significantly now, tell me about the kind of procedures that you do in this position.
So the biggest one is bone marrow biopsies. So we'll use that as a diagnostic tool sometimes to figure out what's going on with the patient. We use it to monitor how treatment is going for the patient as well, especially in the transplant patients or the leukemia patients. They'll do marrows throughout their treatment course to figure out how the treatment is working on them.
Tell me about the intrathecal treatments that you do.
So we also do intrathecal chemotherapy injections. The patients will be down in radiology and someone else will do a lumbar puncture on them, and they'll take fluid out that we usually send off to look for cancer cells in their CSF fluid. And then they'll send off cell count, all the normal stuff. And then we also send cytology so we can see if there's any cancer in that fluid. And then after they take the fluid out, we put chemotherapy into their CSF. It's a very small amount, usually doesn't cause any issues, but we are the ones that inject the chemo.
Let's talk about our diagnoses, the primary diagnoses that we have to worry about in leukemias and lymphomas and these kind of hematologic oncologic situations. Let's start off with the basic diagnoses. Leukemia and lymphoma. Leukemia is white cell based and is coming from the bone marrow. And then lymphomas are primarily occurring in the lymph nodes in the system. What kind of symptoms do you see that differentiate in the early presentation of leukemias and lymphomas
They can have similar presentations. A lot of the leukemias will come in because they're really tired or they'll notice new bruising. They're short of breath. And a lot of that comes down to their counts are low, or they might have a new infection because their white count's low. If their platelets are low, they could have bruising, or if they have a low hemoglobin, they might be short of breath. So some of them are found incidentally or on routine labs, or they're really tired all the time. And then a lot of times with lymphoma, they show up with a lump somewhere. Mm-hmm. So whether it's in their neck, their armpit, their groin, anywhere, they've noticed a lump. That's probably the biggest thing we find. Or they'll have shortness of breath and you do a chest x-ray and you find a mediastinal mass in their chest.
We've talked before on the podcast about fatigue being a very common issue in primary care settings and in emergency room settings, for that matter, in any generalist setting. So fatigue in this case, one of the differentials that we get concerned about would be an anemia that points us to a leukemia-like scenario. Some of the other things, a fever or recurrent fever, presumably of unknown origin in those cases, or is that an actual infection that you are finding a source of infection that might be causing the fever? And then backing up to the CBC.
Sometimes it can be an actual infection, but a lot of time these people have a cyclic fever. A lot of times it's the same time every day, and sometimes we'll even see it when we're concerned for relapse on these patients. If they've already had a diagnosis, they'll start getting a fever every day at 2 a.m. and it's a high fever and it's the same every day and our infectious workup has been negative.
The fever of unknown origin that keeps coming back over time, mm-hmm. In other words. Our list of must not miss diagnoses here. One of the first that you listed in our early discussions was cord compression. Can you tell me about what happens with cord compression and what other conditions it's associated with?
We actually get a lot of rule out cord compressions pretty frequently in patient, especially in multiple myeloma patients or lymphoma patients. What happens with those people is sometimes they'll get, usually it's a mass. So in the case of lymphoma, it would be a tumor, or in multiple myeloma, a plasmacytoma, which is a collection of those plasma cells. And they will be around the spine and they'll actually put pressure on the spine, which can cause neurosymptoms like paralysis. So we want to watch those people closely because a lot of them need to be started on steroids and have a neurosurgery evaluation ASAP.
This patient might be presenting to family medicine, for instance, or primary care, or to orthopedics, or maybe to neuro, and then mm-hmm. The realization that there's a red flag there that might be sending them on for more significant workup in the heme-onc space. Then the workup that you would do to differentiate that from a pure musculoskeletal or neurologic condition then would be a CT scan in that case?
So we prefer MRIs. A lot of these people will come in with just back pain. Mm-hmm. So anytime we have a myeloma that comes in with back pain, we prefer MRIs of the whole spine. And okay. If we're doing one part of the spine, we usually just look at the whole spine because you can get compression at any level. So we prefer MRIs, but if they can't get an MRI, we can do CTs.
Okay.
So back pain, weakness, any symptoms of bowel or bladder incontinence or retention.
Then would you send someone with cord compression and some sort of bulk that's causing that on to surgery? And what service would be doing that surgery?
They would stay on our service, but okay. Since we're the primary, but we always stat consult neurosurgery if we're concerned for cord compression. And then they'll direct us. Usually we'll start steroids. So you start with a big loading dose and then you keep a dose on continuously every 6 hours. But sometimes they will do debulking surgeries. More so in the lymphoma situations. In myeloma, they actually respond really well to radiation. So a lot of times we'll start out with radiation for those patients.
Okay. The next one on your list here, neutropenic fever and sepsis. We alluded to this earlier with low neutrophil counts. That can be a consistent concern with fevers. And then sepsis is obviously another element of that. Have you experienced any specific cases along that line, the classic scenario in which you might talk through that?
So especially in the patients getting chemo a lot, it's almost expected that they're going to come in with a neutropenic fever because a lot of the chemos will intentionally, because they're trying to cure your bone marrow, wipe out the bad stuff in your bone marrow, which then kills off the good as well. Mm-hmm. So then you're getting rid of your neutrophils and that puts you at a big risk for infection because those are your body's first line of defense. So when you have low counts, you're susceptible to a lot of infection. So that's a very pivotal point in these patients because they could die from a little infection.
They are on precautions, presumably, to keep them from getting to that point. What do those precautions look like for those patients?
Usually for all times, we have people on acyclovir, which is an antiviral, because these patients are at risk for shingles. Mm-hmm. We want to prevent shingles because I've seen some really nasty shingles around the eye. Or
herpetic infections that can cause actual damage as opposed to
just... I've seen it in the CSF, too. That was bad. We will put people on antifungal treatment. So usually fluconazole is our go-to. And then antibacterial. So we usually use Levaquin or levofloxacin.
And you are doing kind of prophylactic antibiotic treatments. How long a period of time do they usually need to be on that?
So that depends on how long they're neutropenic. So we base that off of their neutrophil count, their absolute neutrophil count. So if it's under 500, we usually have them on both the antifungal and antibacterial.
Okay. That's really interesting. I think the absolute neutrophil count is one of those things that gets reported in the CBC consistently. Anytime you get a CBC with diff, and noting that absolute neutrophil count is one of those things. Sometimes I see it in my family medicine setting where we get absolute neutrophil counts that go into the very low single digits, and we start to watch that with concern for infection. We have some medications in psychiatry that can actually do that as well, but we like to keep a close eye on those. Absolute neutrophil count is probably the one that really has the most basic risk associated with it. I don't know if you would agree with that or not.
That's the main thing, personally. I know the leukemia people look at blasts a lot. I don't personally usually take care of acute leuk patients. They look at the blasts and the different numbers in the CBC, but a lot of times, at least with the lymphomas and the myelomas, when they're getting chemo, we look at the ANC, which is the neutrophil count.
Moving on to number three on that list is DVT and PE. And presumably this is a result of the kind of proliferation of red cells. What's causing that DVT risk to go up?
Cancer just in a whole is a hypercoagulable disorder. These patients can get a clot at any time. So if they come in with lower extremity swelling, we want to Doppler them, or upper extremity, or if they have any shortness of breath, tachycardia, symptoms of a PE, we want to scan them as well, because despite some of them having low platelets, they're still at risk for getting a clot, which I've seen. And it's a very difficult circumstance when someone has platelets of 20, but then a new clot. And then you're kind of in this balance of you have to figure out which one to treat.
Difficult between the situation that you would normally want to have with low platelets combined with the DVT at the same time. So we have increased coagulation, but at the same time, low potential for coagulation. Do you see those extend into pulmonary embolisms frequently in your service?
I see quite a bit of pulmonary embolisms, unfortunately. If we have one, we'll look for the other, especially PE to DVT, because then that'll sometimes determine how long treatment and how to treat them, especially in the setting of low platelets. But we get a handful of both.
It sounds as if, just from our initial discussion, as if there is a significant amount of whole body care going on with these patients, which is, I think most folks would consider that comforting to know that we're not just farming things out to multiple services to make that happen. You're looking at all of that with one service and having those other services available for consult as you go through the care of that patient. The next one is airway compromise, and I assume that's SVC syndrome, that's superior vena cava going along with that or not?
So that and just bulky lymphadenopathy. So I've seen different lymphoma patients especially. They'll come in, they'll have huge lymph nodes that either deviate their trachea or it just cuts off their airway. And we've even had to intubate some of these people right off the bat because they can't breathe or their lymph nodes are growing so quickly. Or just to safely give them chemo, we've had to intubate some of the patients.
That's not just an initial presentation where they come in and they're having difficulty breathing. That's a rapid growth of those lymph nodes that's occurring even in established patients. Is that something, if you're sending a patient home for a period of time during their treatment, is that something that you are talking to them about and the possibility of that airway compromise being something that you may need to go into the emergency room if you experience these kind of symptoms?
So we always tell patients if you get any shortness of breath, but generally the ones that have airway compromise, you're going to see those from the beginning. They're either going to come in with that or present to the ER with difficulty breathing, or you're going to notice it throughout their stay that you're not going to send them home like that. One case that I remember, she was a CLL patient or chronic lymphocytic leukemia who was progressing to something that we'll talk about later, which is Richter's transformation, which is when you go into a aggressive B-cell lymphoma. And her lymph nodes were growing so quickly that steroids weren't touching it. And her neck just was so large that she just couldn't breathe anymore. She wasn't able to swallow. She couldn't breathe. we had to send her to the ICU, and they unfortunately intubated her during the time so we could give her chemo to hopefully shrink those lymph nodes, because a lot of times lymphoma responds pretty quickly to steroids or chemo if it's going to respond. The hope is that they're not intubated long, that we can give them treatment to kind of calm things down so they can get off of that.
Next in the list, let's talk about tumor lysis syndrome. Can you tell me about that?
Tumor lysis syndrome is when either spontaneously or when you're treating one of the cancers, their cancer cells burst open. And when that happens, those cells will release all their contents. So they release potassium, they release phosphorus, they can skyrocket at LDH, and that can damage the kidneys because it's releasing all these things that are bad for your body. We have to keep a close eye, especially if someone's potassium goes up, that we watch their heart, and we'll hydrate these people with fluids. Uric acid also goes up.
LDH is lactate dehydrogenase.
Yes.
And what do we normally use LDH for?
We will monitor people's LDH because that looks at cell turnover. If it's 100 one day, and then the next day it's 3,000, we're going to see that those cells are breaking apart quicker than they should be. Sometimes with chemo, it can make them break open quicker, so their LDH can go up, which is good because it's showing that it's working against the chemo, but then that can also be bad because then with more cell turnover, you can damage your kidneys because everything's being released. So we'll watch those people very closely with frequent lab draws, and if their uric acid goes up too high, we have rescue medications to help with that too.
Is that a balance then between the treatment that you're giving and the tumor lysis that actually occurs during that time?
We usually just keep the treatment up, the chemo, and then we treat the tumor lysis. So if we know that they're a high risk to start, we'll start at a higher rate of fluids if we can. We always start allopurinol on the patients to prevent their uric acid from going up, and then we can start FOS binders if their FOS goes up, or give them rasburicase, which is that protective med against uric acid, and then we can protect other things. Sometimes patients have to go on dialysis if they have.
That's going to be my next question. Yeah.
Tumor lysis. I've seen that quite a bit.
Again, the whole body treatment really comes into play there, where you're keeping an eye on all these labs, or keeping an eye on the full patient spectrum, and there's another service that you might need to consult during that time. That can be helpful, but I'm sure frustrating to have to think about those kind of things in those moments for those patients. It's kind of a step backwards in their progression of their treatment. Some of the discussions that we have with leukemia and lymphoma, we assume, especially with those two, that there is an associated morbidity and mortality with the conditions themselves. But we had talked about there are other morbidity and mortality conditions that are associated with those. And we talked about some of the symptoms and issues that might crop up already. Let's talk about some of the big issues that start during that time that might be more concerning for you. Let's start with Burkitt's lymphoma is on the list. Tell me a little bit about the morbidity and mortality of Burkitt's lymphoma. I assume it to be pretty big, actually, because I've seen that in some cases. Tell me about that.
So Burkitt's is one of the most aggressive types of lymphoma. So we grade lymphomas into three different major groups. So indolent, which are the chronic lymphomas. The indolent lymphomas are ones that you can sometimes just monitor those patients. They don't always have to be treated. Mm-hmm. And they're a condition that's usually not going to go away. So they're going to live with that. And we have the intermediate lymphomas, which you have to treat. They're like that middle range. So sometimes people can survive them. But then we have the really aggressive lymphomas, which Burkitt's is one of them. It's very aggressive, but it can be survivable because since it is so aggressive, those cells respond pretty well to chemo because they're growing so rapidly and chemo targets rapidly dividing cells. So if you have more cells dividing, hopefully that chemo will work better on it.
I see BL as a acronym. I assume that BL is Burkitt's lymphoma, and that's one of our more aggressive ones. Indolent is one of those words. It is not a common usage word in the English language, but slow growing is the primary usage here. And then we have the intermediate and then the more aggressive versions.
Burkitt's is usually in younger people, and sometimes it can be associated with HIV. I've seen that.
The aggressive cancers in younger patients, like Ewing's sarcoma, for instance, are big focuses of treatment and diagnostics in oncology. Moving on to number three, Richter's transformation. Tell me about Richter's transformation.
That's when CLL transforms into a more aggressive lymphoma, like a diffuse large B cell, for example. It is a lot more aggressive. And like that lady I mentioned earlier, their cells can grow very quickly. So whenever a CLL patient would come in and they're not responding to treatment, or their white cell rapidly increases, or their lymph nodes are rapidly increasing, we want to think of Richter's. We usually re-biopsy those patients, or we'll do a repeat bone marrow biopsy to look for Richter's, because that would be a different type of treatment and a more aggressive treatment.
The next one you have on the list, mantle cell lymphoma.
Mantle cells also can be very aggressive. It's kind of in its own class, but there's a subset that you can monitor. Mantle cell can also be very aggressive, and you want to figure out if it is the kind that you need to treat, because those can grow very rapidly. And I've seen some of them just start out with spontaneous tumor lysis before you even give chemo. And I've seen people rupture their spleen with mantle cell, because their spleen can get so large that it just ruptures on its own, or it ruptures with treatment.
As a result of the breakdown of those cells, in other words. The mantle zone within an individual lymph node is just inside the outer layer, the thinner outer marginal zone of a lymph node, but not in the germinal center, not in the primary central area of the individual lymph nodes. So that's where this one appears to originate. Moving on to the last one, the double triple hit lymphoma. And my understanding of leukemias and lymphomas is that it is always in the background, this genetic testing, looking for what genes are present. Tell me about the double and triple hit and how that applies to genetic testing in lymphomas.
In general, whenever we do a biopsy of a sample, whether it's bone marrow, whether it's just peripheral blood flow, or it's a lymph node or a tumor, we send it off for genetic testing, because there are certain genetic markers in any of the diseases that have a worse prognostic factor. Mm-hmm. With lymphomas, especially like diffuse large B cell, we want to see if they're double or triple hit. So we're looking for certain markers such as MYC, BCL2, and BCL6. And if a patient has MYC with one of the other two markers, it's a more aggressive lymphoma, so we have to treat it more aggressively. So we determine if they have double or triple hit, we have to step up and give them the more aggressive chemo, whereas someone who was just normal diffuse large B cell could maybe get an outpatient chemo regimen, whereas the person with double, triple hit is going to be admitted and they would get prophylactic lumbar punctures with intrathecal chemo.
This is genetic testing of the cells coming from the tumor, from the lymph node in this case. Yeah. And you're seeing more than one mutation in that particular area.
They look for translocations of those areas. Yeah. So if there's a translocation at MYC or either BCL2 and or BCL6, that increases the aggressiveness of the disease. So we have to treat it more aggressively.
BCL2 and 6 are two locations on the chromosomal makeup of that particular B cell germinal center. A MYC is MYC, I believe, yes. Another translocation that we might see in the B cell. Again, a lot of specific locations in the chromosomes for these changes that are going on. Going back then for a second, the symptomatology then is not what's driving those decisions to get more aggressive with treatment. It's the genetic translocations, the things that we're seeing. Even if they are symptomatology, they don't seem to be that ill. Having that genetic makeup of those B cells is far more concerning and is going to prompt a much more...
At least in this case, yeah. If someone has double or triple hit, even if they look fine, act fine, feel fine, we're going to treat them more aggressively.
Moving on to amyloidosis. Tell us why amyloidosis is a concern with our patients in this space.
We can have patients with amyloidosis. Pretty rare, and there's different types of amyloidosis, but we often see it in the setting of either AL amyloidosis or in setting of a patient with multiple myeloma. What happens with amyloidosis is they get amyloid protein deposits in different areas of their body, and especially areas like their gut, their kidneys, or their heart. You want to find this one early, because once that protein gets deposited there, you can't get rid of it. Treatment will help it so it doesn't get worse, but you can't undo the damage that's done. Unfortunately, a lot of these patients are found in an advanced stage, because it is something that's kind of hard to diagnose, and the workup is interesting. So for heart, you do a heart cardiac MRI. They do fat pad biopsies to look for it. They've done kidney biopsies on patients. So a lot of it's biopsy driven, or they can do special stains on a bone marrow biopsy also to look for it.
Are they looking at peripheral tissue at all, elsewhere in the body, or looking for signs and symptoms of an amyloid plaque for these folks?
If there's other areas, like if they have myeloma or symptoms of something else going on, if they're having GI symptoms, they could do a colonoscopy and biopsy the tissue there. I've had a patient that had it in his tongue and he presented with swallowing issues. He had a prolonged workup and it took him a long time, but eventually they did biopsy his tongue and he was found to have amyloidosis in his tongue and he needed to get a PEG tube because he couldn't swallow.
It sounds like this is all kind of playing back into that picture of odd symptoms, fevers of unknown origin, things of that nature that from family medicine perspective, it can be scary, right? Mm-hmm. These are must not misdiagnoses. If we allow these to go on too long in the community without sending them to your services, then we risk that patient having a more advanced case and more advanced staging as they move forward. Tell me about the staging when it comes to these. We talk a lot about the Ann Arbor staging when it comes to lymphomas especially. Can you tell me a little bit about that Ann Arbor staging and how that really plays into your decision-making with those patients?
So Ann Arbor staging is the general staging that they use for most of the lymphomas. It's slightly different in non-Hodgkin's versus Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin's lymphoma is what you think of when you think of lymphoma that's more treatable. So James Conner and Mary Lemieux are two people that have had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it follows a more predictable pathway. And that's why it's easier to treat because usually you can figure out where it's going to go. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is an umbrella term for many, many different types of lymphoma. So like diffuse large B-cell, follicular lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma. So it makes up a lot of things. It's not as easy to treat and each different type has its own subset of treatments. But for staging, there is a slight difference between non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's. Generally, you want to look at wherever the involved areas of the lymphoma are to determine where it is on the staging and how many areas are involved. So if it's one single site, one node, or one organ site, it's going to be a stage one. And in Hodgkin's lymphoma, that one spot can be the spleen. If they have two or more lymph nodes or two or more areas on the same side of the diaphragm, that would make it stage two.
And that's above or below?
Yes. So if it's two spots above the diaphragm or two spots below the diaphragm, that's stage two. And then if it's stage three, if they have areas on both sides of the diaphragm, in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the spleen makes it stage three. And then stage four is usually disseminated disease, so like widespread disease over different areas. We also will break it into stage A or B. So A is no systemic symptoms, and B is presence of B symptoms. B symptoms are sometimes what people do present with. Weight loss that was unintentional, night sweat, fatigue, our constitutional symptoms, weakness, fevers again, some of the big presenting factors. So that plays a role in that B symptoms are worse in the staging versus not having B symptoms.
I've had patients who came to my family medicine service to the psych hospital. And when they came in, they were depressed and having a lot of difficulty dealing with their diagnoses. One of the things that we would always look for in that scenario was the presence of those B symptoms and deciding how advanced is this? Are they miserable, for one thing, with their symptoms, the symptomatology, the fevers and things of that nature that we're going to have to keep an eye on that in a different patient might be addressed differently. Those B symptoms are always something to watch for in general medicine, internal medicine. And then there's an X, right? We can have an X associated with these as well. And X is bulky disease. So bulk of greater than 10 centimeters. Although a space-occupying lesion, you know, in the mediastinum or anywhere really in the body that is close to a nerve, close to a major vessel, an artery, a nervous system structure is going to be of major concern for that individual, regardless of the size of it, more than its proximity to those areas in the body. Certainly the lymph nodes have a lot of proximity to some of those areas in the body to be concerned about. Backing up just a little bit to the leukemia side of things. Leukemias are coming from the bone marrow. In your current position, you are doing more treatment of leukemia with bone marrow transplants. And so tell us how that process works from the beginning of that treatment through to when you are replacing bone marrow in those patients.
So there's different types of transplants. You can do an auto stem cell transplant, which is when you use your own cells, versus an allo stem cell transplant, which is when you use someone else's cells. And then within that type, there's different types. So you can get a half match, you can get a full match, and then it depends on who matches with you. So a family member, or sometimes they do matched unrelated donors. And then the auto transplants are usually in the lymphoma in multiple myeloma patients, and that is a way for them to give really high doses of chemotherapy, which cleans out your marrow from your disease, but then they rescue you by giving your stem cells back. In the cases of leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome, the issue is the bone marrow, so you can't give yourself your cells. So what they do is use someone else's cells. They give you that really high dose chemotherapy, but then they have to rescue by giving you someone else's cells. Then you have to go through the process of your body accepting those cells, and you can get stuff like graft versus host disease.
Rejection, in other words.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. It's the way of the graft rejecting your body because it's seeing you as not itself.
Foreign. Yeah, not so. You mentioned the treatments involving chemotherapy often clean out the bone marrow. So that's destroying the capability of that bone marrow, the native bone marrow, from actually producing red blood cells and white blood cells in that scenario. So that's a pretty significant treatment resetting of that ability in the body. When you do a bone marrow transplant, where do you replace transplant that too?
The areas you can get bone marrow transplants, so they can use peripheral blood. So that's like kind of like a blood transfusion, actual bone marrow donation or a cord donation. So the most commonly used one now is peripheral blood. When they give it to the patient, it's through an IV. So it's like a blood transfusion.
Okay.
And then the chemo is systemic, so it goes through the whole body. So then the transfusion will eventually hopefully go through the whole body.
It doesn't sound as if it's quite as invasive as the biopsy itself that initially occurs, yeah, which is going directly into the
bone. It just goes through a apheresis line.
Let's move on to possible referrals. You mentioned a couple of these. And really, a lot of this is intended to be family medicine, right? So the PA education way of doing things is to talk about things from a family medicine perspective. And then you guys go out into the community as new PAs and work in specialty services. And that's why I bring you back, because I know you've got the basis, that's for sure. And I know that, but I am curious about things that you think family medicine needs to pay close attention to in the community for potential referral. Let's talk about some of those elements.
A big thing that can catch a lot of the issues is getting lab work. So when someone comes in for their yearly physical and you get the lab work, you might notice some of these abnormalities, such as abnormalities in the CBC, or when you're thinking of myeloma, you're looking at their protein levels. Mm-hmm. So just your normal yearly checkup could show you some abnormalities if you get their lab work.
And typically looking at sending them along for a more specific, as you mentioned, in the case of the proteins, looking at albumin and total protein, that may be indicating a more significant plasmapheresis, where we're looking at what kind of proteins are present in the body. And if any of those are present at a level that would be concerning, like our IgGs and IgMs and IgAs. The screening lab in those scenarios, that preventive medicine side of things, where we're looking at basic labs that give us a good bit of information, and it's always good to keep some of those things in the back of your mind when you're looking at those, complete blood count for CBC or a complete metabolic panel for a CMP, would give you more information about that patient and then might give you a reason to send them along. That's that aspect of family medicine that we talked about in a previous episode with Tony Wilson. There are must-not-miss diagnoses everywhere when you start to look at those kind of conditions at times. How about talking about new lymphadenopathy? So in other words, what kind of lymph nodes are we really concerned about in those patients on physical exam?
You want to, during your routine physical, you can do a good physical exam on the patient. You want to feel for lymph nodes. You want to feel along the front and the back of their neck, around their clavicles, their armpit, their groin, in front and behind their ears. Or if they notice any lumps or bumps, obviously feel those, because that can lead to other diagnoses.
What do those lymph nodes usually look like or act like when they present in that fashion?
They're usually firm. They're non-mobile. They're not going to be moving around a lot.
The tissue underneath.
Okay. And they're usually not tender.
Not tender. So in other words, no pain from it, but enlargement and fixated with a very firm lymph node would be one of our big concerns there. And then leukocytosis, another one of those big lab findings on CBC. So what do those usually look like on the lab work?
So if they have a high white count, or low white count, so leukopenia, could be a sign that something is going on. A lot of times in a leukemia, they're going to have a high white count because you have all those bad white blood cells in their body, and that will show because there's cells in the peripheral that are getting out of the bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Or if they have really bad disease in their marrow, they could have a low white count, meaning you're not even getting a chance to make those white blood cells because there's so many bad cells in the marrow.
And then pancytopenia is something you have listed here. Pancytopenia being all cell lines, red cell, white cells, are being decreased in the periphery. And so what's that usually a sign of?
So that can be a sign of leukemia, because those leukemia cells are packed in the marrow so much that your body isn't able to make those cells, like in the leukopenia situation, but you're not making red blood cells or platelets either.
We also have listed FUO, the fever of unknown origin, and that goes along with that relapsing and remitting fever, and with or without a specific cause. How often do you see full sepsis in those patients, full-on sepsis?
Oh, we see septic patients all the time.
All the time.
No matter if we think it's a fever of an unknown origin or not, we always work up a full infectious workup. So we do blood cultures, urine cultures, chest x-ray, or anything else that we need. If they have sinus pain, we'll do a CT of their maxillofacial. If they have cellulitis, we'll do a scan of their leg. So we'll do a full workup of any symptomatic areas or just our routine things to look for infection, because we don't ever want to miss an infection. Or more invasive testing. Sometimes people need bronchoscopies or biopsies of different areas, but you never want to miss an infection. So you have to prove it's not an actual infection before you can call it a fever of unknown origin.
I find that interesting. Again, back to the family medicine side of things and the generalist perspective, fevers caused by something, again, you have to look back at the trend. Is there something else going on here with this patient? Is there a consistent fever presenting in this patient? Or are they just having multiple infections in the community? You know, either one could be possible. But again, those are going to raise a red flag for a lot of practitioners to move along to the next level. And then the last one on that list is the CRAB criteria. I always have to remind myself what the CRAB criteria are. So CRAB is hypercalcemia. The next one is renal function. And the A is anemia. And the B. The B is?
Bones.
Bone symptoms. Light occlusions and,
yes,
and changes in the bone and possibly a pathologic fracture. So the calcium levels are generally speaking increased. So that's more calcium being released into the bloodstream from the bones in that scenario.
CRAB criteria goes with multiple myeloma.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the big things you want to look out for if you suspect someone has multiple myeloma. The kidney stems from the myeloma proteins are very bulky. And they can clog up the renal tubules and they can cause a lot of kidney damage because they're so big. So some patients present in full renal failure and some have needed dialysis before you've even fully diagnosed them because their myeloma was so bad that it destroyed their kidneys. Sometimes it's reversible, sometimes it's not.
Well, those are very big proteins. Those immune proteins that are being dumped into the system are really clogging up the works in the kidneys at the very least. The anemia side of multiple myeloma.
The issue with multiple myeloma is the plasma cells. So the immunoglobulins, IgG, M, and A are the big ones. And then the light chain disease, so lambda and kappa, those can also replace your bone marrow. So if you have really bad myeloma, you're not making the proper cells that you should be. Or it could be a sign of renal failure also, because when you have renal failure, you don't make EPO, which causes anemia. So it can be two-sided in some of the cases.
Multifactorial and the cause for that particular anemia. And then light occlusions would presumably be a later presenting issue?
Not necessarily. When you think of high calcium, you think of the stones, bones, abdominal moans, and psychotic groans. Sometimes these people will present with altered mental status and you check their labs and their calcium is 14, which is over the normal limit. So this lady had a high calcium. She was confused. She came in with bilateral broken knees. She had a creatinine of 4 and she had a hemoglobin of 7 when she came in. So she had all 4 of the CRAB criterias and she was in the hospital for a very long time because she needed 2 surgeries. We had to give her chemo. And that's a lot to figure out when you're trying to reverse all of those different areas and help all of those different areas all at the same time. But sometimes just working on one area helps the other. So if you fix the calcium, you might help the kidneys, hopefully.
2 broken knees. So let me just kind of back up to that just a second. Were those femoral fractures?
One was femur and one was tibial.
Wow. And pathologic fractures are things that really cause us a lot of concern in medicine in general, orthopedics certainly, but family medicine, when someone has a fracture that really doesn't have a cause that is significant, you know, but falling from one's feet in someone who doesn't have significant osteoporosis, for instance, shouldn't cause a major fracture. So these fractures are occurring stepping off of a curb or with normal muscular contractions at times. When those occur, then backing up to things like multiple myeloma as a potential causative for that weak area in the bone. And this causes focal lesions in the bone that allow those fractures to occur in those spots. What kind of imaging do we do to look for those kind of light occlusions in the bone?
So if you're just generally looking, like say their arms hurt, you would scan that area. But if you're concerned for myeloma, you want to do a skeletal survey. So that looks at all the long bones in the body and also their skull to look for lytic lesions.
I do recall skull being one of those areas that has that lytic potential, and that can cause some changes in the shape of the skull as well, as I recall. Right? Can we talk for a second about the ID consults that go along with being on your services? Tell me, so what kind of infections might you find that really pull in the ID folks and make you want to get a more specialized look at their infections?
A lot of our patients have ID consults, most of them. So oftentimes, even if they just have a neutropenic fever, will get them on board, but you're not usually taught to look for zebras in school, but we do see zebras. There are expected ones that we can find, but we also get some less common things than other people because in the general population, people aren't usually as immunocompromised, so these people are susceptible to a lot of different things. Like I've seen MAC infections.
Can you define MAC for us?
So that's Mycobacterium avium complex, which can cause severe lung disease. I've also seen PJP pneumonia, which is Pneumocystis jirovecii, which can be very rare. We get people with weird fungal infections and mucor, which can invade into your sinuses and your brain. Seeing necrotizing fasciitis that has eaten away at a wound or a bed sore. And unfortunately, these people can get that from very minor things outside.
So the same way that HIV maybe presents with some characteristic infections, we can see some of those, some characteristic infections that go along with this. So as you said, the MAC and the Pneumocystis jirovecii versus the Pneumocystis carinii, which is one of the characteristic infections of HIV patients. Is that a concern for you in that setting? Is an HIV test a part of your screening and discussion in those moments, or is that a differential for you?
Usually on everyone, we send an HIV and hepatitis panel to make sure that's not also concurrently happening, or especially if they're going to get something called Rituxan, which is a monoclonal antibody, it can reactivate viral infections. So usually as part of our workup when we're diagnosing someone, we send those off.
I'm guessing that the differential diagnosis list for your service is as broad as it could possibly be because you're covering so many different things. Have we talked about all the things that you think might be possible so far? Are there common differentials that pop up in your patients?
Well, just in diagnosing, just from the very beginning, it could just be an infection. So mono or EBV, but that can reactivate, causing lymphoma down the road, or just strep throat. So some people just have swollen lymph nodes because they have a sickness, a viral illness, which can cause that.
I did notice that EBV is listed a lot in the reference material about the differential, the early differentials, and some of the causatives, actually, of some of these conditions in hemonc. So I would assume that EBV testing is pretty early for you, Epstein-Barr virus and mononucleosis.
Not usually. They can send EBV off the tissue if they biopsy it, but if someone comes into the ER, they can do a rapid mono test. If they see other imaging, they're most likely going to send them for more testing.
You're not seeing EBV as a primary condition. You're seeing it as a next step for most of those folks. They're getting it diagnosed elsewhere, and then you're seeing those make their way to you. As in orthopedic surgery, we would often know the diagnosis before the patient walked in the door because family medicine or an emergency room had already seen them when we knew that this was a fracture of a certain bone or a very lax joint caused by a traumatic or non-traumatic injury. And so we knew what was coming when it walked in the door for the most part. So it sounds like you have often gotten past the point where EBV is really on your significant list of differentials there for early.
Yeah, a lot of times it's what kind of cancer is this?
Well, I appreciate you coming back and hanging out and talking about this. Again, it's nice to be able to ask you the questions instead of you sitting across the desk from me and asking me all the questions like you did when you were in PA school. But it is fun to have you back. And of course, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Many thanks to our esteemed guest, Lydia Popacek. That's it for now. Be sure to check out the podcast website at beexcitedhq.com for more episodes, show notes, and full transcripts of every show. Email us at contactbeexcited@gmail.com with questions, comments, or future show suggestions. And of course, follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Be Excited Podcast for news, new episode notifications, and maybe a picture or two. Thanks for listening and remain excited.